This podcast is a production of Community Covenant Church in Eagle River, Alaska, a place where real people meet a real God to live in a real world. For more information, check out our website at communitycovenant.net.
Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 through 34. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the people of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, "Know the Lord," because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. And from Luke chapter 15, verses 11 through 32. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants." So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him?" "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found."
Okay. Yeah, that was my fault. Sorry. Whew, that's easier. As you know, I've tried to, in a humorous way, keep you informed of my Alaskan experience. And I'm going to do it again today. I'm sorry. I'm just going to apologize right up front. This past week, the reason I wasn't here is because I had received an invitation from Curtis Ivanoff, who's the director of for the state of Alaska Covenant Church, to travel with him to Nome, and then from there to a small village called Elam, somewhere up in no man's land, really, and preach. So last Sunday, I was in a little village of about 300 Alaskan natives preaching. And I don't know where to start other than to say this. The day that I was supposed to leave by plane was Saturday from Nome, so that I could go to this little village, Elim, which is, I don't know, 35, 40-minute plane ride away on one of these little bitty planes, you know, that bounce all over the place. And you got to know something about me. I get terribly motion sick. I have for my entire life. You know, when my family went on vacations and I was a little kid, you know, we'd get all packed up in the car and take kind of those long 2-week vacations in the car. And the last thing my mom would give me would be a bucket. She said, use it if you need it. So that's me. I've always been like that. So the weather was really bad last Saturday in the Nome area. And I'm thinking, little plane, bad weather, this is not good. And so, if you're like me, you know what I'm talking about. I'm getting all anxious about this trip. I get out there, I can feel, you know, my pulse going up. The snow is coming down this way at first, and then the wind kicks up, and now the snow is going sideways, and we get called to walk out to this little bitty plane at the Nome Airport to take us to Elim. Well, at this point, I'm thinking to myself, this is crazy, I'm going to die, and I didn't even get a chance to say goodbye to my wife. So I'm sitting in the plane, I'm all buckled up, I'm kind of shaking with anxiety, and the pilot's sitting there, you know, and these guys are rough, tough Alaska types, and, you know, he's checking all his dials, and we move out to the end of the runway, and I texted my wife at this point. I said, the weather is really bad, this is a really small plane, please pray for me. And then I grabbed the arms of the seat that I was on, and I just said, "Okay, God, you know, if Elam needs me, I'll go." And so we're sitting at the end of the runway. The pilot is just about to press the throttle, you know, so he can get enough speed so that the plane can get off the ground. And I'm just thinking, "Okay, I'm about to die." And all of a sudden, the pilot pulls the throttle back, takes off his headphones, and says, "We're not going today." And I said, "Thank you, God." So, anyway. So that next Sunday morning, I didn't get out to get to Elim. So I went to church at the Nome Covenant Church. They send you their greetings, the people at the Nome Church. Pastor Harvey wanted to express greetings to some of you in particular. I won't name you because then nobody will feel left out. And then I got on a plane Sunday afternoon, blue skies, clear, calm. It was the most beautiful flight one could ever imagine. I dropped into Elim. I know this is a long story. And it was about mid-afternoon, late afternoon, and the plane drops me off with my bag and then takes off again on this remote airstrip. And there I am, standing in Elim, Alaska, on an airstrip that I've never been to in my entire life, with my bag, looking, you know, kind of lost, and wondering, okay, what do I do now? And about 10 minutes later, a woman on a snow machine comes riding up. And she says, "Are you Brad?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Get on." How'd she know? Anyway, yeah. One last thing. Did any of you stay up last night, this morning, 12:30, 1 o'clock, and see the aurora? Unbelievable. That's the first aurora I have seen with my own eyes. So this past week has been an unbelievable experience for me. Thank you for letting me go. Thank God for not letting me die. Let's start this sermon. This is a good time. Well, as you know, we're in a sermon series about how important it is for you and I to understand that the stories that we have, the stories that we tell, the stories that we frame our life around are important, and they're even more important when we connect them to God's story, right? And so the story that we find ourselves in today is the continuing saga of the people of God, the people of Israel, as they kind of fumble their way through this developing relationship with a God who's behaving in a way that they have never seen a God behave before. See, in most cases, in the ancient world, when people worshiped a god, it was because they needed something from that god. They, you know, kind of like my airplane prayer, they needed safety. They needed a good season of growing. They needed to have, find a nice harem of women and to choose a wife from. These were the reasons why people worship God. But then comes along the God of the Bible, Yahweh. And this God is trying to convince the people of God that there's a different reason for having a relationship with this God. And it took these people of God, these people of Israel, a while to get it through their thick skulls that this was different than all of the other gods that all of the people around them were worshiping. And so this story that we find ourselves in then today matters, because what it does is it provides us with a trajectory for our future that is different than the one that we've been on. It's kind of like the airplane. You know, the story that I would have told a moment ago would have been very different had I survived, had we taken off in the middle of that storm. It would have been a different story. And what God is trying to do here is trying to help the people of Israel understand that their day-to-day stories can and should connect to this larger story. And if it doesn't, this is what happens. We miss the opportunity, you and I, we miss the opportunity to see beyond our own particular small stories. Now, if you like living in your small story, then whatever I'm about to say will be of no consequence. But there are, and I've lived long enough, there are times when our small stories get really tiring. If the grind, if the daily grind that you and I are engaged in is all there is, then we probably all should take a small plane in the middle of a storm. You know, the challenges that we face when the only story we have is ours, they become much larger, right? And the daily grind, as I said, becomes much more burdensome. And when we live out of our own stories without seeing them in relationship to this God who wants to be part of our story. So, at any rate, I want to say this to some of you. I know that some of you may be in a place where you don't entirely trust the Bible. Maybe it's because you grew up in a really harsh religious environment as a child, and you're thinking, you know what, that's just fairy tales. And I get that. So if that's who you are, don't completely turn me off. I want to convince you delicately that the Bible, this grand story that the Bible tells, really does matter. And so the reason why I think it matters is because it presents to us a picture of a God of creation, a God who knows how to deal with our failures, a God who's used to people who are rebellious. Remember, I said that a couple weeks ago. And so today, Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, as well as lots of the prophets, presents us with another facet, really, of this story that we find ourselves in. And that facet that I want to kind of hold up for us to look at today is the facet of restoration. God has written a story about the restoration of God's people. So, you know, like any good literary study, if you are going to feature a particular word or concept in a sermon like this, you probably want to know what it means. And so this is what I discovered as I went to the dictionary and looked up the word restoration. Is it there on the screen yet? There we go. Thank you. An act of restoring or a condition of being restored. Okay, that makes sense. A reinstatement, a restoring to an unimpaired or an improved condition. The story we find ourselves in is about a God who is a God of restoration. It's about a God who is in the business of restoring to an unimpaired or an improved condition everybody that's sitting in this room, if you want to be that. The most stark example that I have seen recently of this kind of experience is the movie Les Miserables. Have you seen that movie? I watched it recently, and it's a story really about restoration, if you think about it. If you haven't seen it, don't worry, I'm not going to give anything away. But there's a scene in the movie, Les Miserables, where a criminal named Jean Valjean, if I pronounce it right, shows up at a priest's house, and the priest, doing his Christian duty, welcomes him into his home, feeds him, lets him stay overnight, and this criminal basically gets up in the middle of the night, steals all their fine silver, and disappears, thinking this will help support his whatever his habit was. The constables find this criminal, and they bring him back to the priest, and they said, "We found this silverware in his backpack. Does this belong to you?" The priest says, "Why, yes, it does. In fact, I am surprised that he didn't take these silver candlesticks, because I gave these to him as well." And so there you have this criminal, Jean Valjean, standing there about to be indicted for his crime, only to have this priest say, "Hey, you didn't take it all. Here are some candlesticks." And at that moment, you realize that this is the beginning of a transformation that is about to take place in this criminal's life. It's a story of restoration. Well, Jeremiah the prophet is telling us a story about restoration. And he's speaking to the people of Israel, who are a rebellious people. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. And let me just give you a really brief background about how rebellious they have been. In fact, Jeremiah, in the first 30 chapters of the book, and the verses that we read come from chapter 31, Jeremiah has spent literally the first 30 chapters sort of castigating the people of God for all of their misbehavior and saying, "See, no wonder you are, you know, in the predicament that you find yourself in." Because in 587 B.C., Babylon, this great power that was one of the neighbors to Israel, came in and basically decimated the country of Israel. Took all of the people of Israel and dispersed them into the farthest reaches of their empire, because that's what they did. And when they did that, then they moved their own people, the Babylonians, into the important cities, including Jerusalem. And the identity then of the people of Israel, people of God, is at risk, because if you don't have a place to call home, then how can you have an identity? And that's how wars were won and lost in the ancient world. You conquered somebody, you absorbed their population into yours, and they ceased to exist. And the people of Israel are then relocated all over the place. And Jeremiah, as I said, spends the better part of the first half or more of his book kind of saying, "Look, you get what you deserve." And by the way, that's what prophets do most of the time. They speak truth to power, right? They're not afraid to look at people in the eye and say, "Folks, you did this, you did this, you did this. This explains it all." And if you want to boil it all down, what Jeremiah is really trying to do is he's trying to answer two kind of critical questions that the people of Israel have asked during this disbursement into the cities and the country of Babylon. And the questions that they're asking are these: how did we get in this mess? How did this happen? Now, you know, that's a question that we often ask after we've already found ourselves, you know, kind of in the weeds, right? We don't ask it beforehand, we ask it after. And that's exactly what the people of God are doing. And the second question that they're asking is there any hope for us in our future? Now that we're in this mess, is there any hope? And the answers to these two questions are basically this section of Scripture that we read a moment ago. Jeremiah wants the people of God to know that their present circumstances are not too large for God. Their current hardship, even though there's every good reason for why they find themselves in the predicament that they find themselves in, their current hardship is only temporary in God's grand scheme of things. What Jeremiah is actually trying to do here is he's trying to say, let's take a step back. You messed up. The result of your misbehavior has meant that you have been conquered by a foreign power. You've been dispersed into their various places. But you know what? The God who you worship is not letting you go. That's what Jeremiah is essentially trying to say. And if you look at the beginning of this chapter, of this section that we looked at, look how Jeremiah begins. He says, a new day is coming. A new day is coming. Can you hear the optimism in that statement? A new day is coming. You know, it's like somebody said to me the other day. They said, as the days get longer and the sky gets bluer, we know that spring is just around the corner. A new day is coming. A time is coming, says Jeremiah, when God is going to make a new covenant with His people. A time is coming. And this is hard for us to understand, I think, as contemporary sort of readers and listeners into this text, because we don't really understand the whole nature of covenant. The way we think about covenant, even though it's in our name, in fact, it's in our name for this very reason that I'm talking about today, but when we think about covenant, we automatically think about contracts, right? We think about business contracts. We think about legal contracts, agreements. And in our mind, when you make an agreement with somebody, it means that both parties have to keep their side of the deal, right? Whether it's real estate or marital or business takeover, merger, acquisition, whatever. In our system, both sides of the agreement have to keep their part of the deal. Otherwise, the deal is sort of null and void. And then people get lawyer up and sue people, and that makes a good living for lots of people. But anyway, in God's notion of covenant, it's not like that at all. You see, God knew from the very beginning that the people of Israel were incapable of keeping their side of the bargain. He knew it. But God made the covenant anyway, and in the ancient world, the only thing that keeps a covenant operational is that one member of the covenant agreement keeps their side of the bargain. And you guess who that is every time? God. So Jeremiah is essentially saying this. He's saying, in the past, God has made a covenant with the people of Israel, with you, and that covenant was dependent upon at least one of the parties being faithful. And in every case, it's always been God, and it hasn't been you. And so here we are in this predicament. But Jeremiah isn't done saying that. He's saying God wants to make a new covenant with you. It's a new covenant that's not based on the same rules of the old covenant. This new covenant, this new agreement, is no longer going to be measured by the law, right? That's how you know if a person's keeping the covenant, if they're keeping the rules. Instead, the new covenant would be written on their hearts. And instead of having external measurements for whether or not we're doing our side of the deal, now God was going to make an agreement with us, and He was going to write the covenant on our hearts. Now, this is subtle, but it is also a significant shift for the people of God when you think about it. Where once they spent their days fulfilling the letter of the law, right? You get up and you go, okay, I got to do this, I got to do this, I got to do this, in order to make sure that my agreement with God is intact at the end of the day. That was the way it used to be. But now they would genuinely desire to keep a covenant on the basis of, get this, a relationship with God. How radical is that? And then a little further down in this section, Jeremiah writes this, and he puts it on the mouth of God, and he says, God says, I will be their God, and they will be my people. I will be their God, And again, this is a really, really remarkable statement because in the ancient world, you didn't have relationships with the gods. You didn't do that. There were no gods that could be known. You just sacrificed to them so that you could improve the chances that you would get what you needed. This was unheard of. And just like our day, there is a difference between knowing a lot about someone and knowing somebody personally. You know what I'm talking about? You know, I've been reading lately a lot about the gold rush in Alaska. Here we go. And so I know a lot about George Carmack, who is allegedly the first person in the gold rush down in Skagway to hit gold. And when I go down to Seattle in a month or two to visit my son, I'm going to go to the Klondike Museum down there, and I'm going to learn more about George Carmack. But you know what? As much as I can study George Carmack and try to get inside his mind, I will never know George Carmack unless he and I, when he's long dead, by the way, were able to sit down face to face and have a relationship with each other. That's what God is saying through Jeremiah to the people of Israel. Here we are. We are a church that's located in suburban Anchorage in Alaska. And you, many of you have been here much longer than I have, and we know something about Native Alaskans, right? We've read about them. Maybe we've been to Nome or been to one of the villages, Bethel, Kotzebue, whatever. But I got to tell you, you can know a whole lot about Native Alaska, but it's not until you sit down at a Native Alaskan's table like I did last weekend and have them serve you dried whale, fish oil, and other sundry items that I have never tasted before in my life until you discover what Native Alaskans are really like. In short, the Old Covenant was about your head, getting it all straight in your head, but the New Covenant is about your heart. The God of the New Covenant, Jeremiah says, is a God of second chances. Oh, thank God. The God of the New Covenant is more concerned about having a relationship with us, and He's more interested in being known by us than the God of the Covenant is interested in being right all the time. Can you believe that? You see, the same God that Jeremiah is describing in this text to the people of Israel is a God that chooses to forgive us in the midst of our shame. The God that Jeremiah describes is a God who chooses to give us hope rather than catch us doing wrong and slap us on the side of the head and say, "Watch out." The God of second chances knows us and desires to be known by us. That is the significance of what Jeremiah is trying to say about the people of God and their relationship with this God of the New Covenant. Well, there are many examples throughout the Scripture about this God of restoration. In fact, the Old Testament is filled with a picture of this kind of God, and believe it or not, so is the New Testament. In fact, one of the most familiar stories that you, I'm sure, everybody here knows about a God like this is found in Luke chapter 15, where we have the story of a man who had two sons. And we read it earlier this morning. And this man had some wealth and had some property and had some animals, livestock. And his younger son, as you know, comes up to him one day and says, "Hey, Dad, I've been thinking about my future options, and I'd be just as happy if you wrote me a check now for my half of your legacy so that I can go off and get on with life. Thank you very much." Now, if one of my sons comes to me and says that, I'm not sure I'm going to respond the same way that this father responded in the parable of the prodigal son. But this man you know, wrote him a check. The young son went off. You know the story. He squandered it. He spent it on all kinds of crazy stuff. And he finds himself basically living at a standard of living that is way below what the servants at his father's house are living. And he comes to his senses, the Bible says. He comes to his senses and he says, wait a second, this is crazy. I've screwed up. I have sinned against God and I have sinned against my father. I'm going back. So he wrote a speech. And he checked it to make sure it reflected, you know, sort of good political correct son coming home. And he folded it up and he put it in his pocket and he trudged back to the house. And you know what's really interesting about this story? Is that when we read this story about the prodigal son, that we often think that the prodigal is the main character of the story. That this young son who takes all the money and runs off and has a good old time, and some of us can relate to that son, I'm sure. But the central character of the story is not the young son. It's the father. What Jesus is doing in this text is giving us another picture of a God who is a God of restoration. A God who, when he sees his lost and dead children from a distance, he doesn't stand there with his arms crossed, waiting for us to come walking up with our head down, dragging our feet, ready to give a speech about how sorry we are for all of the bad things that we've done. This God sees the sun in the distance and he runs. Now, how uncouth is that? I mean, think about it. They're wearing these long, flowing robes. I know women know this, but have you ever tried to run with something down around your ankles? But that didn't matter to this father. This father sees his son off in the distance and he runs and he embraces him and he says, that which was lost, that which I thought was dead, is now alive. And then the picture that Jesus portrays of this father. He wants to have a party. Every time I think about this, and I think about 300 natives in Elam, Alaska. I think about how many students at Eagle River High School. I think about 900 students at Eagle River High School. I think about 50,000 people who live in the greater Eagle River Chugiak Mat-Su Valley. Maybe I'm wrong, but it doesn't matter. And I'm imagining a God who, when one of those people figures out the mess that they've got themselves in and comes home, that this God of restoration, is there to embrace and to show compassion and throw a party. So here is the $64,000 question. Maybe with inflation it's gone up. What difference does it make if we understand the character of a God like this? You know. What does it matter that Jeremiah describes a God who desires to know and be known, and then Jesus comes along, you know, years later and paints a picture of the extravagant love of a father that defies all of our expectations? What does it matter? You know, being the pastor of a church in our day and age is a little dicey sometimes. Because on the one hand, I've laid my heart out here at least a couple times since I've been here, and probably today more than I intended, but fundamental to most pastors' call is a sense and a desire to communicate the character of a God like this Father. And for those of you who have been wandering around in the weeds and, you know, haven't figured out yet that you've screwed up, you will. And I want you to hear me clearly that it's never too late for God, for you to go back to God and be embraced by God. But so here I am as a pastor saying, I want that message to get out. But also, there's also this tension that many of us live our lives as very faithful, very honest, very upright, very caring people. We've spent our whole lives in the church, and we've crossed every T, and we've dotted every I, and we've tithed, and we've done this, and we've done that. And we're a little bit like the brother, because we're saying, wait a second, what's all this hoopla about? What about me? I've been here the whole time. You never threw a party for me. We're not all that way, and it only comes in little glimpses here and there. But what I want to say to you is that this Father is concerned about all of us. And if we miss the extravagant love of the Father in our effort to keep all of the rules that religion puts on us, then we've missed the point. It is not about rules. It's not about religion. And those of us who've been embraced by the loving arms of a Father are the first to recognize and often practice that same kind of love toward those who've messed up. I always know when somebody understands the nature and the character of God like this, when they are confronted with the reality of having to do the same, maybe with a wayward child, maybe with a spouse, maybe with a person that you work with, whatever. The culture in which we live is very different, has a very different view about the character of God than the one that I am describing to you today. You know that because you live in it as well as I do. And for this reason, you and I, we must be diligent in our efforts to present a God who is standing by the gate and waiting to receive lost sinners rather than keep checking a list and checking it twice to see who's been naughty or nice. I had to finish it that way. That's the kind of God that we have to work extra hard as the people of God to communicate to a culture who does not believe in a God like that. And I will end with this. I can say with some confidence, and with the same confidence, actually, that Jeremiah said to the people of God, there is a new day coming. In fact, it's already here. When you and I can be known and know a loving Father in spite of all of our faults and all of our failures. There is a new day coming. Friends, if the Bible is true, if the picture that Jeremiah is painting in the Old Testament is accurate, and if the extravagant love of God looks anything like the compassionate Father that we see in the story of the prodigal son, then all I can say to you is, welcome home.